Each month, the Security Ledger podcast informs and entertains an audience of thousands of technology and information security professionals. If that sounds like an audience your company is trying to reach, consider sponsoring one of our podcasts. We offer per-episode sponsorships of our weekly podcasts, which feature news, analysis, and discussion of the most important cybersecurity topics of the day. Or you can commission a custom podcast to highlight your executives, researchers, and subject matter experts. To learn more, point your web browser to securityledger.com/sponsor. Hello and welcome to the Security Ledger podcast. I'm Paul Roberts, editor-in-chief at the Security Ledger. In this week's episode of the podcast, number 202.
The Trump administration failed to prioritize cybersecurity. It did that from eliminating or downgrading cyber coordinators in both the White House and at the State Department, to firing the Director of Cyberspace and Infrastructure Security Agency, to President Trump's irrational downplaying of the seriousness of this attack. Enough's enough. In an age when so much of our lives are conducted online, cyber attacks must be treated as a serious threat by our leadership at the highest levels.
Well, it almost didn't happen, but on January 20th, Joseph Robinette Biden was sworn in as the 46th president of the United States. More than any president since maybe Franklin Roosevelt, Biden inherited a country in the throes of a crisis. Actually, multiple crises. The COVID virus has killed hundreds of thousands of U.S. residents and tanked the national economy. Right-wing militia groups are stirring and threatening to topple Democratic government. And if that wasn't enough, the weeks between the November election and Biden's January inauguration brought to light evidence of what is perhaps the biggest cyber intrusion by a foreign adversary into U.S. government networks ever, the so-called SolarWinds Solar Storm hack. Even before SolarStorm, Biden, as a candidate for the presidency, made clear that cybersecurity was going to be a top priority for his administration and that he'd seek a reset for government cybersecurity policy. The wide-ranging hack, purported to be at the hands of the Russian government, of the U.S. Treasury, the U.S. Department of State, the U.S. Department of Justice, and Homeland Security, among other agencies, just added fuel to what many perceived as the roaring dumpster fire that was federal IT security. But what will that reset look like? To understand a bit better what might be in store in the months ahead, we devoted this entire episode of the Security Ledger podcast to interviewing experts on federal IT security and cyber defense. In our second segment this week, we're going to be joined by Mark Weatherford, the Chief Strategy Officer at the National Cybersecurity Center, to talk about the biggest cybersecurity challenges facing the incoming Biden administration and what strong federal leadership on cyber looks like. But first, before you can do a reset, you need to understand what went wrong in the first place. In the case of federal cybersecurity, that list of what went wrong is pretty long. In our first segment, we're joined by two experts on cyber policy who are familiar with the U.S. government's many struggles to get cybersecurity right. Lauren Zabrick is the executive director of the Cyber Project at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at the Harvard Kennedy School. She's joined by her colleague, Paul Colby, who's the director of the Intelligence Project at the Belfer Center. To start off, I asked Lauren and Paul about the biggest challenges that President Biden is facing out of the gate as he looks to do a cybersecurity reset in the federal government.
My name is Lauren Zabrick, and I am the executive director of the Cyber Project at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at the Harvard Kennedy School.
And my name is Paul Colby. I'm director of the Intelligence Project at the Belfer Center for Science and Technology and International Affairs at the Harvard Kennedy School.
Paul and Lauren, welcome to Security Ledger Podcast. So we're talking to you today because obviously we're in the early days of a new administration. And one of the big to-do items and big initiatives for the incoming Biden administration is cybersecurity. SolarWinds hack made that clear that it needed to be a priority, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. Paul, your background is from the intelligence community, and you've worked both in government and private sector. Give us a sense, coming into this new administration, what the big to-dos were for the Biden administration? What were the kind of glaring problems out there that they needed to take on right out of the gate?
Thanks, Paul. Well, look, I think the first one is to reprioritize cyber as an important issue and to put the people and resources that they need to behind it. And I think you're seeing that in terms of the appointments and prospective appointments across a range of cyber roles, the reestablishment of some cyber roles, and proposals to put some significant new money behind government efforts to defend and build up and harden government networks.
Yeah, this has been kind of a recurring problem for the government. It seems like there have been a lot of kind of cyber czars and various bites at the apple over the years, but none of them seem to have worked out the way we intended.
In the last few years, I think that you saw a diminution of focus on cyber issues. I think you saw some denial of real problems and unwillingness to address them, and certainly unwillingness to put the kind of resources organization together to fight them. And in particular, haven't done what's necessary to mobilize not just government resources, but to mobilize government and private sector together to better understand the threats and better defend against them.
Can we talk about who some of the key appointments are and positions to fill in this administration? I mean, we're in the process now, obviously, of getting a lot of the president's new administration confirmed where that's necessary or just, you know, hired and put into place. But what are some of the key roles that they need to fill? Either Paul or Lauren, whoever wants to take a swing at that.
I'll take a swing. He has a number of appointments that he is looking to fill and has filled already. So he has appointed Anne Neuberger to be on the National Security Council for the Director for Cybersecurity, as well as my old predecessor, Michael Solmeyer. He is also on the National Security Council dealing with cybersecurity. He has appointed Avril Haines as the ODNI. And, you know, for some people, you know, maybe, well, how does that have to do with cyber? Absolutely. There's, you know, cyber threat intelligence and you know, on the classified side, and of course, being able to process and analyze that information across the federal government. One of the key roles that he needs to fill, a couple of them rather, are, you know, the CISA, Cybersecurity and Information Security Agency Director, as well as the new National Cyber Director role. This is actually a really big one. This came out of the Cyber Solarium Commission. And that recommendation was passed within the NDAA for 2021. And that actually comes with a large office of, I think, 75 people. So this is going to be a really key role. And, you know, there's a lot of momentum and a lot of talk behind that and a lot of conversation about how this will actually be successful and what, you know, this person will need to do to be successful.
And Lauren, could you just give us just a brief synopsis? You mentioned a Solarium report and some of the recommendations, some of the changes in the National Defense Authorization Act, the NDAA. What was the short version of what those recommendations or conclusions were?
The Cyber Solarium Commission, you know, was this bipartisan, bicameral organization that was, you know, in Congress, but it also pulled in experts from the private sector as well as academia. They had a number of task force that focused on, you know, really key areas for cybersecurity, really trying to further, you know, this whole notion and, you know, something that I've talked about a lot as well, that, you know, really cybersecurity is national security. And there needs to be a lot of improvements and changes, you know, with the way that our nation approaches that. And so the commission actually came out with a number of recommendations. I think it was upwards of 50, maybe even more than that. And in this NDAA, they got in 27 of them, and then they're going to be looking to get in, you know, a number of more recommendations in the next NDAA or at least other legislation going forward. You know, it covered everything from, you know, the creation of the National Cyber Director role to even recommendations for strengthening relationships with the private sector to having, you know, sort of technical, like the joint collaboration environment, how we can actually, you know, pull information together.
And for that National Cyber Director, I know that President Biden, it looks to be tapping Jen Easterly, who's at Morgan Stanley now, to fill that role. Do we know anything about Jen Easterly and her background and what she might bring to the job?
You know, I'm actually really excited about this. She comes from, you know, the government and military and has that background. And she actually had served on, I believe, National Security Council, but, you know, has some really deep government military analytic experience. But the fact that she was just most recently in private sector and she's right now the head of resilience at Morgan Stanley, I think is a huge indication for the Biden administration's, you know, focus on relationships with the private sector and, you know, what we can do going forward.
Strikes me, and I'd be interested in your thoughts. I mean, cybersecurity at a high level seems to be one of the few areas in Washington, D.C. there these days where there actually is a fair amount of bipartisan agreement and, you know, cooperation between Democrats and Republicans on the issue. On the other hand, the topic itself was politicized during the Trump administration, particularly around the role of Russia, both in the 2016 elections and then, you know, obviously subsequent cyber offensive operations they may have done in the United States, concluding with the SolarWinds compromise, which isn't just SolarWinds, it's a lot of other companies as well. Some thoughts, you know, Paul and Lauren, how did that tension or politicization of particularly Russia and Russia cyber offensive, did that set us back in any way in terms of our ability to mount a united front against these challenges?
I think it's hard to say that any specific piece set us back, but look, I'd contrast focus on Russia with, in the last few years, with our focus on China. I think on China, we're came closer to getting it right in terms of calling out the activities, publicizing specific operations, indicting individuals, et cetera. I think on the Russia side, we probably lost the plot a bit in terms of not focusing on it, partly because there's so much Chinese noise, but also in terms of just a deterrence piece of not focusing on Russia. I will say, however, that with when General Nakasone came in to NSA and they focused on the Defend Forward campaign, i.e. pushing forward to gather intelligence and conduct operations to work both as a deterrent factor as well as to help provide tactical defense. I think that was a seminal change in the last administration. And I would expect, I don't know how you feel, Lauren, but I would expect that would continue even after SolarWinds, with some people claiming, well, this shows that SolarWinds shows that Defend Forward doesn't work. I think that's probably too.
Yeah, I would agree with that. We're having a panel actually this week on SolarWinds, and one of our guests, Dr. Erica Borgard, you know, she, I think, put it really well when she said on a recent panel that it is too narrow of a reading. And, you know, when you're planning military operations, you can't be everywhere at once, right? And you're operating in red and gray spaces. And the SolarWinds operation obviously happened in blue spaces. And so, you know, this isn't a, you know, a binary, a black and white sort of issue. This really, I think, is more of a, you know, a clarion call for increased, improved, enhanced private-public sector collaboration, not only on sharing of intelligence and, you know, but also that coordination of, you know, defensive operations. I agree with you, Paul. I don't think the Biden administration will at this point move away from, you know, the persistent engagement, Defend Forward posture.
One of the questions that seemed to come up regarding SolarWinds, and again, this is a very sophisticated operation. We call it SolarWinds because that was one of the companies that was targeted, but it seems pretty likely it wasn't the only one. Was this question of whether this is actually espionage and kind of just more kind of an example of the to and fro between governments who spy on each other, just pretty much as, of course, this is what governments do, or whether it was an act of cyber war, whether there was truly a cyber offensive operation. I'd be interested in your thoughts on that. It seems like to me that those are lines that are not very clearly defined, and so it's going to be a really hard question to answer, but I'd be interested in your thoughts.
This is a big debate right now, right? And you're right, the lines are not very defined. And I do want to put out there that especially in the public discourse, when we say something like cyber attack, I think in, you know, most people's minds, people conflate attack with an act of war, right? And so I think we need to make that a little bit more clear for the public so we can have fruitful discussion about it. But yes, at this point in our understanding, it was, you know, an act of espionage. However, you know, I think because we've sort of been so, you know, used to in the last, you know, 5 to 10 years of, you know, with cyber operations, this is targeting, you know, the civilian population, the civilian infrastructure. And that is an issue that I think we need to speak more about. Now, as you know, more and more details of the operation are uncovered, and you know, I think we can sort of look at it as like a spectrum of activities, right? Like the act of intrusion and exfiltrating information, like those actions to, you know, get into a network and, you know, get very close to doing certain things, you know, there can be thin lines there. And so the difference could be, you know, a matter of, you know, to put in Bruce Schneier's words, but a matter of a few keystrokes. And so there is a spectrum, and, you know, we need to, I think, recognize that.
Lauren, I agree. I wouldn't call this a cyber attack. I think I'd call it what we'd call it. We'd call it a cyber operation. And I think it's useful. Often in cyber, it's not helpful to use physical world analogies. But I think in this case, it is useful. So I think the physical world analogy is, you know, this is the same thing as not just one agent being recruited to purloin records from government and private sector companies, but it's recruiting up to 18,000 agents and penetrations to purloin information and steal files and send it back to their masters in Moscow or Beijing or wherever. I think what really distinguishes this from a typical human intelligence operation is simply the scale and breadth. And you're right, they called it SolarWinds, but SolarWinds was just, you know, for those who are not aware, SolarWinds was just the entry mechanism using SolarWinds software to gain access to dozens of government agencies, thousands of U.S. companies, and presumably international companies as well, to be able to reconnoiter, look around what's on those networks, to be able to sit back and watch how the victims respond, and presumably to emplace other tools, malware that let them go back in or maintain persistence on those systems. So I think the scale of the attack, the breadth of the attack, the sophistication all make this, you know, a seminal event. But it's not an act of war, as some have called it. It's an espionage operation, which would have had potential if different malware tools were employed. And I don't know, they may have been or may have been in place destructive malware tools. So instead of using the malware to exfiltrate proprietary information or secrets or government emails, whatever, if it would be used to be destructive across IT systems or operational technology systems, then that would have been a very different thing.
So what are the different, as the Biden administration looks to respond to this, like what are the different modalities, right? Like back in the Cold War, if you identified a spy network, you could kind of roll it up, right? And, you know, if they were domestic individuals, you could try them. If they were diplomats, you could kind of kick them out of the country, or maybe, you know, close embassies or take that type of action. In the cyber context, like what can we do really to send a message that kind of enough and watch out? And what do you think the Biden administration will consider? Like what, again, what are the modalities they can consider as they're looking to do that? Because my guess is they're going to want to do that. But the question is how.
Yeah. You know, I think this operation, honestly, it really, I think, presents opportunity for our country to finally say, OK, you know what, let's draw some actual lines in the sand and let's actually say this is what is appropriate in cyberspace and this is what is not appropriate in cyberspace. So I think it presents sort of the opportunity for us to, you know, really lean forward. Whereas, you know, the number of years in the past, like we, you know, we've sort of ceded, I would say, leadership in that domain. And so I think that's probably one of the biggest things that we could do, especially on the international stage. Of course, there are things like, you know, sanctions, which, you know, we did sanction Russia from their aforementioned 2016 activities, but, you know, 2 years later in 2018, you know, and like you said, indictments, other things. But I think there are more things that we could do to really help shape the environment. Paul, do you have any thoughts on that?
I do. I mean, it's a really difficult problem set for a lot of different reasons. So I think you have to start with a really clear-eyed understanding that we're in an age of perpetual ambient cyber conflict. And it's not a one-sided conflict. We're not sitting here as victims in this, you know, just being abused by others. We're also out doing our own cyber operations, both on the civilian and military side. So I think it's important to recognize that while we can express outraged indignation that others would penetrate our networks, we're doing the same thing as part of our national defense. And that then I think helps inform how you're going to respond, right? So you need deterrence. You need to be able to try to encourage others not to conduct those operations. The best way to do that is to have the best possible intelligence on what their plans and intentions and what their capabilities are, so that you can mount adequate defenses, you can have forewarning. So, you know, the old phrase, it takes a spy to catch a spy, applies in the cyber world as well. The better we understand what they're going to do, what they want to do, and what they're capable of doing, the better we'll be able to mobilize their defenses, organize a collective defense, inform private sector, provide warning, et cetera. I think sanctions has been an overused tool. And the more we use them, the less effect they have. I would take them off the table, but they need to be very precisely targeted. Indictments, I think, in some cases, and exposure of specific individuals and operations in China networks is good, but that's tactical. It's whack-a-mole. And then finally, going to the piece of, you know, at what point do you start to actually consider seriously engaging in discussions, negotiations about what international cyber rules of the road, cyber norms, cyber behavioral norms, or cyber arms control, right? And I think that's also an extraordinarily difficult piece for a couple of reasons. One is that we have no trust that any of our cyber adversaries would actually, even if they agreed to something, that they'd follow through with it. Our relations with Russia and China are so low and our trust level is so low that makes it very difficult to come to agreement. I think also importantly is I'm not sure that we know what, if anything, we would agree, how we would agree to limit our own behavior. Would we agree to stop developing certain types of cyber weapons? Would we agree to moderate our behavior or to limit, restrict our behavior with regards to types of cyber espionage, cyber tools, cyber operations that we do? That's a really good question. I don't know.
Are there parallels in the Cold War to this, you know, the sort of mutually assured destruction paradigm?
I think there's some, but I think they're tough because
it's not clear that there's mutually assured destruction.
Exactly right. With nuclear weapons, it's pretty clear, right? In 20 minutes, you know, we could each wipe out each other's civilizations. With cyber, it's not, you know, it doesn't have that visceral, physical sort of understanding. You know, we understand that lights can go out. We understand that, you know, society can be disrupted, that financial systems can be disrupted. But we haven't seen that kind of massive disruption that would drive us to the table. I think, you know, what drove Cold War arms control was really after the scare, the existential scare of the Cuban Missile Crisis. It was only then that we really started thinking about, wait a minute, we need to get this under control. We haven't had that yet with a cyber attack or cyber operation. And I'm not sure that we could.
Hopefully we won't. So there's at the core of this Biden administration is this $10 billion cybersecurity plan, Build Back Better plan that they've committed itself to. $10 billion sounds like a lot of money for cyber, although in the scope of the federal government, it's not a lot of money. But what are your thoughts on it? Anything strike you as particularly innovative, promising in the plan?
I was looking at the plan and understand there's, like you said, about $10 billion overall, $9 billion for CISA, for GSA to enhance their cybersecurity and shared services, to enhance their security monitoring and incident response tools like the CDM, the Einstein, things like that, which I think is really important. Those systems need constant tuning and upgrading, you know, just to make sure, you know, as Paul was saying, you know, that we have the best defenses available. And part of that, you know, in addition to, you know, the classified intelligence and understanding intent and capabilities and that sort of thing, but also having data. And that's going to be extremely important. But also, you know, the money for hiring and shared secure services and things like that. One of the things that I've heard a lot about CISA, you know, it's a great organization, great people. They do a really important job, but they just don't have enough money to do the things that they want to do. And so I think this infusion of funding is going to help greatly, not only for, I think, sort of internally and streamlining certain things and working you know, with the federal government and trying to protect those networks, but also working with the private sector and trying to get more done on that aspect.
Yeah, I just pick up on that point. I think the $10 billion addresses a problem, but not the problem. You know, so it throws the bulk of it towards, you know, reinforcing, strengthening government networks. I saw very little focus mention or allocation of that towards what's really needed, and that's helping to develop a national collective cyber defense. How do you mobilize the private sector in particular that, you know, owns, runs, controls, and is biggest victim in terms of potential damage on operations against us? How do you mobilize a real cyber defense? I would want to see much more resource and attention.
Lauren, you've spoken and written about diversity and racism in InfoSec and the need to really tackle those problems really as a matter of national security. So, looking at the incoming Biden administration, some of the names that are being bandied about, it definitely encouraging that there are women in senior leadership roles. Talk to us a little bit about kind of your thoughts on that and how that might play out in terms of the policies that, you know, we pursue going forward.
Yeah, I think the Biden-Harris administration really understands that diversity is national security. You know, and my partner in the hashtag Share the Mic in Cyber campaign, Camille Stewart, you know, she has written a lot about this and, you know, because she has lived this, to be honest with you. You know, everything from just the way that tech actually works or, you know, how certain adversaries may target a certain population, you know, to sow division, you know, that is all wrapped up within, you know, the concept of national security. And so that the administration really understands that having people from, you know, diverse races, genders, backgrounds, you know, experiences, I think that they really see that that's going to just make everything even stronger. And so, yeah, I'm really excited to see all the different people getting nominated. It's, you know, a really, really awesome thing to watch. And, you know, I look forward to seeing how he builds out the rest of his cabinet.
Lauren, Paul, thank you so much for coming on and speaking to us on the Security Ledger podcast. It was really great having you
on. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. It was our pleasure.
Lauren Zabrick is the executive director of the Cyber Project at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard Kennedy School. Paul Colby is the director of the Intelligence Project at the Belfer Center. Up next, as Harry Truman famously said, the buck stops at the president's desk. But what does executive leadership look like when it comes to federal cybersecurity? To find out, we invited Mark Weatherford into the Security Ledger studios. Mark is a chief strategy officer at the National Cybersecurity Center. He's a former CISO for the state of California and a former deputy undersecretary for cybersecurity at the Department of Homeland Security. In this conversation, Mark and I talk about the importance of presidential leadership on cybersecurity and about what, if anything, the Trump administration got right in its own cyber policy during the past 4 years. To start off our conversation, I asked Mark what he thought the biggest challenges facing President Biden are as he comes into office.
Mark Weatherford, I am the Chief Strategy Officer at the National Cybersecurity Center.
Mark, welcome to Security Ledger Podcast.
Good morning.
I guess maybe a good place to start is, you know, kind of coming into office, in your mind, what are the big to-dos for any incoming administration, especially given the last 4 years and everything that's happened?
You know, there are just hundreds and hundreds of what I think are, you know, urgent cybersecurity priorities. But, you know, if I had to say one thing that would be a priority above all, and that is that the president be vocal and leading out on discussing cybersecurity. Leadership starts at the top and, you know, the nation follows a positive direction. And so I think, you know, President Biden coming out and as he has already done, said that cyber was going to be a priority in the administration. He wants to give the Technology Modernization Fund over $9 billion to modernize, you know, federal cybersecurity. I think he's setting the tone appropriately now, but really, I think everyone is kind of sitting back and kind of going, okay, what's going to be the position? You know, after the last 4 years, we're honestly, you know, we've kind of moved backwards a little bit and deprioritized the visibility of cybersecurity. I think crucial that, you know, that the president kind of make this, you know, it's not one of his platforms, but certainly it needs to be one of his priorities.
You know, obviously, there's just so much happened during the Trump administration, much of it not good. Was there anything that they got right or any positive developments in the last 4 years? Or were we really more or less treading water as a country, or if not, maybe sinking a little further beneath the waves?
Yeah. So, you know, like him or not, you do have to give, you know, President Trump credit for what he did that was positive. And he put out a national cybersecurity strategy document, which was pretty good. He put out several executive orders related to cybersecurity. So, you know, they didn't move backwards. I mean, they established the CISA organization during the Trump administration. And no, even though he ended up at the end, you know, firing Chris Krebs, CISA came to life during the Trump administration. I don't think that it wasn't a priority and it wasn't visible. In fact, in cases where the president had the opportunity, President Trump had the opportunity to lean forward, you know, he kind of minimized the cybersecurity discussion, which if you're not leading forward and leaning forward, you know, the nation follows the president, follows the positive message of the president. And we just weren't getting that in the last administration.
I think cybersecurity has been one of those areas where it truly is bipartisan in D.C. and not many things. There aren't that many issues you can say that about, but it does seem to kind of cross, you know, party boundaries, support for cybersecurity. But I think that if you were to look, you would say, well, in some ways, the Trump administration or Donald Trump himself politicized cyber, certainly in relation to Russian and also Chinese cyber activity, because it all kind of led back to the core question around the 2016 election and so on. And so it all became kind of fraught. You know, it was okay to bash on the Chinese, but maybe not so much on the Russians. And it seemed to me, I don't know about you, but it just seemed needlessly thorny, where if you talk to experts, there really wasn't that much thorniness to it.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. That's probably one of the best ways I've heard it described. And that is, it was needlessly thorny. It was like, there's no need to do this. We could have handled this in a so much more of an elegant fashion without making it controversial. And anyway, you know, we are where we are. And again, I am really hopeful that, you know, that the Biden administration is going to help us to move forward.
Okay, so he's proposed more or less, as you mentioned, around $9 billion, $10 billion to be invested in cybersecurity. Where does that money need to go? Where is the need the most urgent?
You really have kind of three different organizations involved in cybersecurity. And I'm really, really trivializing this a lot. But, you know, you've got NSA, you've got the FBI, and you've got DHS. And these are the three, mm-hmm. I would say, primary organizations that have their fingers in intelligence and cyber. And so creating a more cohesive relationship, you know, that money needs to go to modernizing the infrastructure and modernizing the policy relationships between those organizations. Each of the federal agencies, federal civilian agencies, they have their own IT infrastructure, their own security infrastructure. They hire their own people. They have their own policies. They have their own budgets. And there's very little coordination across the government between these organizations on how, when, and why they're spending on different things. So I think some synergies are available to tie these together a little bit better. So, you know, from a procurement perspective, from a policy perspective, we could do things much, much more efficiently.
Hmm. You mentioned earlier SolarWinds. I mean, obviously the Biden administration kicks off with in the midst of probably the biggest cyber incident, certainly in the last decade. Which is the SolarWinds hack, SolarStorm, or whatever you want to call it. For you, I mean, as you look at it, what are the lessons of SolarWinds? Does this change in any way, you know, what the priorities should be for the incoming, you know, for the Biden administration?
A couple of lessons. One, that what we've discovered here is that what we feared for a long time is that infiltrating a company like SolarWinds in the way that they did is really, really, really hard to discover. And once a vulnerability has been discovered and a technology has been compromised the way SolarWinds was, it's, I won't say it's impossible, but it's almost impossible for all of the downstream effects of that to be realized. So, you know, SolarWinds was compromised.
Yeah.
they issued patches, and everybody who was a SolarWinds customer, you know, downloaded the patch like they're supposed to. And how were they to know that the patch was compromised?
You know, signed by the manufacturer, right? Signed update. Yeah. You know, yeah. I mean, that's not an easy one to catch.
It's not.
I was going to say this isn't the first software supply chain attack. There was the CCleaner attack, obviously not Petya. I guess is one of the messages that maybe that advice of just, you know, as a patch comes out, apply it as soon as you can. Do companies need to be thinking a little bit more strategically and saying, well, mitigate the vulnerabilities or the threats, but give ourselves a 6-month window to make sure that nothing funky is going on with the patch, or even a 3-month window or something like that. I mean, that actually still wouldn't have helped in this case, but I don't know.
You know, that kind of goes against everything that we've been talking about.
Yeah, it does. I know.
One of the biggest lessons out of this is how vulnerable our supply chain is.
Yeah.
You know, and when you think about the supply chain risk, it's really frightening to me. It's frightening that the downstream effect of this is, you know, just profound. We've talked for a long, many, many years, talked about, you know, understanding who our suppliers are and what the vulnerabilities of our suppliers are, and making sure that our suppliers have good security controls that we agree with. But what we haven't done is we haven't talked about the third, fourth, and nth tier suppliers that are supplying our suppliers.
And of course, you want the government to have a best of breed. You know, you want them to be using a SolarWinds instead of creating their own network management software. You know, that wouldn't work out, right?
Yes.
So you want them using, you know, the best tools that are out there. And yet, as you point out, it does obviously increase the risk of these, you know, third-party compromises. And we're seeing those everywhere. It's not just government, right? I mean, the sophisticated hacking world has clued into the fact that it's much easier to pick on a downstream partner or provider or reseller than it is to go right at the main target.
I think that's probably one of the biggest lessons for the bad guys from SolarWinds, is they're going to realize, holy cow, you know, if we could just compromise upstream, and we could even target this. I mean, how hard would it be to say, okay, we want to target company X because we want to, you know, acquire their technology. And we know that they work with this supplier or this vendor. So we will just compromise that supplier or vendor and find our way downstream to where we actually really want to go. I think, you know, that's probably a pretty darn big eye opener. You know, for the less sophisticated bad guys, the more sophisticated bad guys have, you know, they've played this long game forever.
What is the right approach? What is the solution for the federal government to both, you know, harness the benefits or the power of the private sector, startups and cloud providers and you know, applications, but also manage this increased supply chain risk that SolarWinds underscores? How do you square that triangle, as it were?
We have to start expecting and requiring more out of people that we're spending money with, and that's both in the government and in the private sector. And, you know, shame on anyone who signs a contract with a company that doesn't have good security and they didn't do their due diligence in asking the right questions to begin with.
Okay, final question, because it's actually one of the most interesting points you made in the article, which was on election security. You recommended that the Biden administration should really focus on establishing a national voting system that provided a high degree of integrity and security and assurance around voting. Talk about that and kind of what you envision.
Yeah, so, yeah, I mean, this is kind of a testy area because, you know, you don't want to, there's a line you can't cross with states' rights. You know, states own their own election systems. And we all get that. We acknowledge it. We agree with it. But there needs to be some consistency. And I would even back up, you know, I'm not even going to talk about this from a technology perspective. I want to talk about it from a policy perspective. And that is, You know, we've actually had these discussions for over a decade. I can remember when I was the CISO for the state of Colorado, the Secretary of State, and this must have been 2006, 2007, 2005, somewhere. Secretary of State came to me and he said, "Hey, can you go look at these voting systems and see if they're vulnerable to anything? You know, we want to. So I took one of my really smart guys and said, "Hey, go do an investigation, do some analysis, and we'll write a report on it." And came back and said, "Yeah, these systems are vulnerable for a whole lot of reasons. There were physical security issues, logical security issues, policy security issues, you know, that we just hadn't thought of back then." So my point that I'm driving at here is, let's do this today in 2021. Let's don't wait till 2023 to say, "Oh my God, we have this election security problem. We need to throw all this time and money at it in the next 12 months to fix the problem." We have 4 years right now, or 3 years, 3.5 years to fix this thing. And it needs to be a priority today. February 2nd, 2021, we need to be working on this. And I know they are, but it needs to be a national priority. You know, this is, more than anything else, this is embarrassing to the United States, the most technologically advanced country in the world, and we can't conduct an election securely. It's just stinking embarrassing. And as I said in the article, you know, I want the world to be amazed by the lack of drama in 2024.
Mark Weatherford, thank you so much for coming on and speaking to us on Security Ledger Podcast, and love to have you back soon.
Sounds good, Paul.
Mark Weatherford is the Chief Strategy Officer at the National Cybersecurity Center.